It's time to junk the World Anti-Doping Agency and throw it into the same bin with prohibition. It's a failed social experiment that has yielded nothing but a larger form of corruption, a crooked, self-dealing bureaucracy headed by a bunch of careerist drones trying to legislate a morality they themselves do not possess. That's from a column in the Washington Post calling for the legalization of performance-enhancing drugs. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. Russians banned from the Olympics, athletes stripped of their medals, baseball greats and Tour de France winners with tarnished reputations. There seems no end to the news stories about doping in sports. What are the ethical and social issues involved in anti-doping strategies in sports? Why did my guest publish a column called Let 'em Take Steroids? Joining me is Norman Faust, Professor Emeritus of Pediatrics and Bioethics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Welcome back to University of the Air.
Thank you, Emily. Great to be here.
I kind of have this feeling I might end up doing this as a debate rather than as an interview, but I'm fascinated to see why you take the stance that the performance-enhancing drugs that we hear so widely about as doping, that maybe it's a better strategy to legalize them. Before we get to the whole area of sports and doping, let's talk about what performance-enhancing drugs are and how they're used just in general society.
Sure. Well, everybody uses performance-enhancing drugs, whether it's coffee in the morning, caffeine in the morning.
Guilty.
Or alcohol at night, or Viagra on the weekends. Literally everybody takes something to enhance their performance or uses other technologies to enhance their performance. Nobody's ever suggested there's anything wrong with trying to perform better and or use things that are safe and preferably legal, but that's a separate issue, which we'll get to. So nowhere else in life do we consider it immoral or morally problematic to try to improve your performance. You know, we send our kids to Suzuki lessons. We send them to school. We put them on diets. We do all sorts of things to try to help them lead better lives, be stronger, quicker, faster, smarter, kinder, gentler, more musical, or whatever it is that parents value.
Okay, but you say send them to school. We send them to school to learn, to work hard, to do their homework. We don't give them drugs to make them perform better at school, do we?
Well, sometimes we do. If a child has ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, sometimes we do give them drugs to enhance their performance. And people will say, oh, well, they're sick, they have a disease, and we're just treating a disease. But we know from just talking to any college kid that people who don't have that label can perform better in school, can get better grades, can have a better chance of getting into graduate school or whatever they want to do if they take the same drugs that we give to the ADHD kids. So lots of people, millions I would say, use drugs to enhance their performance. Sometimes it's very young kids, as with ADHD, but there are other young kids who don't have that label, which is a somewhat vague label to begin with. It's not really crystal clear who has it and who doesn't. Some parents understandably say, you know, if Junior across the street can take a medicine that makes him or her do better in school, why can't my kid?
So I guess I hadn't really thought of performance-enhancing drugs as including things like coffee or Ritalin or Adderall or something, but because we think of it more some specific steroids that get used in sports. But so would you extend that even to something like energy drinks and dietary supplements and
all of the above? And I don't see any reason to limit it to drugs. That is, I would, to me, the issue is performance-enhancing technologies, some of which are external, like computers or running shoes or cars or bikes or things that help us perform better. And sometimes it's internal, like dietary supplements or drugs or alcohol or what have you. The issue is, why should we be getting upset about people who want to enhance their performance in any way? There's some reasons to set some limits to it, but the basic concept of trying to do better is universal in human civilization.
You said something in a column you wrote about how there's been performance-enhancing techniques ever since the Greek Olympians started wearing shoes.
Right. My understanding is the original marathon was a barefoot race, and then somebody had the bright idea of putting something on his feet to allow him or her to run without getting sore feet. And I'm guessing there was an uproar about it at the time and a big debate about whether to ban it. But pretty soon, the usual solution to these sorts of advantages that people seek is not to ban them, but to equalize them. And so pretty soon, everybody started wearing shoes and have for the last 2,000 years. So that's one example. And actually, around the same time that putting shoes on crossed their mind, strychnine, which is a particularly dangerous and even lethal drug, we know was used by some athletes back in historic Greece to enhance performance in their version of the Olympics.
How would it have enhanced performance if it's a kind of poison, strychnine?
Well, all drugs have side effects, so yeah. All drugs are poisons if you take them in the wrong dose. But strychnine is a stimulant. I mean, it jazzed them up. It's sort of a particularly bad form of caffeine. It is something that jacks you up. Whether anybody died from it, I don't know. And whether it actually worked, I don't know. But we know that at least they tried it.
You've been interested in this topic of, you know, should we legalize the performance-enhancing drugs for a long time, not just recent Olympics and the banning of Russian parts of Russian teams. But, you know, going way back, this has been something that you're interested in. How did you come to that position? It doesn't seem to be, you know, a common one. and I bet you've had a lot of flack over the years about it. But I'm just curious, in your own background as a pediatrician, as someone interested in ethics, in medicine, you know, kind of the overlap between social behavior and medical practice. How did you get into this area of performance-enhancing drugs in sports?
Well, to say it's not a common view understates the case. Tom Goldman of NPR once called me the loneliest man in America because of my views on this. But it's actually getting less lonely. There's a rapidly growing number of critical thinkers, journalists, and others who have come around. And in fact, about 10 years ago, a survey showed about one-third of people are beginning to come around to this view. But to answer your question, I was sitting on my couch eating peanuts, watching the 72 Olympics, when an American swimmer named Rick DeMont won a gold medal in swimming and was tested and was found to be positive for a drug called ephedrine and had his medal taken away from him and was banned from all future competition. Ephedrine is an over-the-counter cold remedy. It's in pretty much every cold remedy that people buy and has for 30 or 40 years. And DeMont had exercise-induced asthma, which about 20% of all athletes do. And he found that – so this drug is like epinephrine, which mm-hmm. is a well-known effective treatment for asthma. And he found out on his own that just taking these over-the-counter things could relieve him of his asthma. And he had always taken it before a race. But before the gold medal race, he asked the team physician, is this okay? And the team physician falsely told him, yeah, it's fine, not bothering to check. And for reasons that I don't understand, it was on the banned list. He was tested and was found to be positive. And I'm watching this, and it seemed to me very unfair. He certainly wasn't trying to cheat. He was treating a disease. Mm-hmm. He had a real disease. So why it was on the banned list? Anyway, there were other anti-asthma medicines that were allowed. Why not this one? It has no performance-enhancing qualities for people without asthma. And this is true of many things on the list. So this all struck me as just sort of bizarre and weird and unfair and ethically problematic. But then as I began to think about it, I realized that it was more complicated, that DeMont, without the ephedrine, could probably swim laps around 99.9% of the human population. He might even be able to win a medal. And so the reason he was taking it was not because he was sick. If it weren't for the gold medal race, he never took it just for his daily activities or even for practice. So he took it only before a race. That is, he took it to enhance what was already a supernormal level of ability. He took it to win, and not just to win, but to set a world record. Mm-hmm. That is, the reason he took it was the same reason that Ben Johnson 20 years later took steroids and why everybody...
Was that the sprinter, Ben?
That's Johnson? Right, yeah. The Jamaican-Canadian sprinter. Come back to him in a minute. So it's this distinction between treatment and enhancement seemed to me a fuzzy one. Why things were on the list seemed fuzzy. And so that's how I got interested. And 40 years later, it's still as fuzzy and as problematic as it was then.
And as much in the news. Oh. It honestly seems every day there is something having to do with banned substances, doping allegations. It's just you can't have sports coverage almost without having somebody that's under a cloud of suspicion or who had denied for years that they were taking something and then finally confesses that they were.
And it always will be until we legalize it because, as I said, athletes like everybody else will always be trying to enhance their performance and they'll always be a step ahead of the testers. So when one thing gets banned, they'll seek something out. And this will go on to the end of time.
So back to the example you gave, it seems one thing to treat asthma, but you're saying he was not taking it for that purpose, really. He just happened to have found out that using this substance gave him an edge. Then why wouldn't it be unfair to other athletes who were not taking it, especially when you're in a competition where we've all seen the results where it's down to a hundredth of a second, you know, the difference between a gold medal winner and someone who doesn't even get a medal comes down to the tiniest fraction of a difference.
Yes, it is unfair when there's unequal access. And that's why the rule should be to equalize access.
That you mean that everybody should be taking ephedrine or whatever it is?
Whatever is safe and effective. Everybody already takes hundreds and hundreds of other things. I mean, the list of drugs and diets. So, for example, carbo loading. Every endurance athlete, bikers, marathon runners, carbo loads before a race. They take carbohydrate. That's a drug. I mean, it's a chemical that you take into your body to change the structure and function of your body so you can run or bike longer and faster without getting tired. Pretty much all endurance athletes now train at altitude, like Boulder, Colorado, where the oxygen levels are low, to stimulate their bone marrow to make more red cells, to jack up their hemoglobin, because then you have more oxygen-carrying capacity.
And what does that do? I've read a lot about that, where they're in these chambers or they're up at high altitudes and get the greater incidence of red blood cells. But why does that make you a better runner then?
Well, this is actually the best example of the hypocrisy and the inconsistency and the scientific muddled thinking about performance enhancement. So first to answer your question, one reason you get tired is because you can't get enough. Your body wants more oxygen because you're exercising hard. Your red cells are where the oxygen gets transported to the tissues. And if you have more red cells, you can carry more oxygen. If you're anemic and you don't have enough red cells, you get tired more quickly. So when the Kenyans and the Ethiopians started winning all the long-distance events about 30 or 40 years ago, people began to wonder, why is that? And they found out that one reason was because they live in these mountains and the oxygen level is low and their hemoglobins, their blood counts were higher. So rather, nobody said, oh, well, we should ban the Kenyans or we should force them to live at sea level. The answer to that was, well, we should equalize access to that. Well, one way to do that is to go to some, we have mountains in America, so the Olympic teams began training in Boulder, Colorado to achieve the same result. Well, everybody can't afford to go to Boulder, Colorado, or it's inconvenient. A lot of our Olympians have jobs and they can't stop everything. So, for example, the Olympic speed skating team built an arena in just outside of Milwaukee, the Pettit Ice Arena. And when they built in a special room where they could have low oxygen levels and simulate high altitude so that they could jack up their hemoglobins. The Olympic maven said, that's fine. It's the same thing as the Kenyans are doing. But when Lance Armstrong and thousands of others began doing the same thing by just injecting EPO, so I should go back and say, what happens physiologically when you expose yourself to these low oxygen levels is your body gets a message, oh, not enough oxygen. Your kidneys make this hormone called EPO or erythropoietin. That goes to the bone marrow and tells it to make more red cells. So Lance Armstrong and others bypassed the low altitude thing and just injected the EPO, but for exactly the same purpose and physiologically the same way. And Armstrong and others also did the most natural thing of all, which is to transfuse their own blood into themselves. That is, they would donate a unit a month ahead of time, let their body equilibrate, and then re-inject that blood an hour before the race. So here you have four ways of achieving the same result that does enhance mm-hmm. performance. It's no question about that. There's two ways of doing it that the mavens say, oh, that's fine.
So you can either go to the mountains, you can be in a chamber. Those are okay.
Right.
But you can't do something that involves an injection either of your own blood or of the protein or whatever,
exactly.
hormone.
Right. So it beats me as to why methods one and two should be okay and three and four not.
I suppose it's certainly with the mountains, it sounds more natural. You know, you go up to the mountains, you haven't taken a needle to yourself. There's something different just in the way that seems.
Well, the natural-unnatural distinction yeah. is another claim that's made that has no coherence. I mean, athletes ingest all sorts of things that are very – it's not natural to carboload. It's not natural to take creatine, which is a dietary supplement that athletes think enhances their performance.
And that's legal?
Yep. There's thousands of things that are legal. Why some things get on this banned list like ephedrine in the DeMond case escapes me.
So with the – Lance Armstrong case and sort of the rules on that. Who sets the laws or the rules for the athletes? You know, is it an international team of physicians? Of who makes the rules?
There are a whole bunch of people, and they don't always coordinate very well with each other. So there are the sports officials. So you know, there's a biking federation and a track federation, and they each have their own rules. There's then the country Olympic committees. There's then the International Olympic Committee. There's then the U.S. Anti-Doping Association, which does the testing. And then there's an international. And there's actually a complex web, and these groups don't always see eye to eye about things. So, for example, forget drugs for a minute. Let's talk about another technology that makes you run faster. How about if I amputated your legs and replaced them with big springs mm-hmm. So that you could leap over tall buildings and run even faster? Well, we have this famous runner from South Africa, mm-hmm. Oscar Pistorius, who didn't chop off his legs for that reason. He did because he had a deformity when he was a child, and he had to have his lower legs amputated so he could just walk. And he turned into this world-class athlete. And some of the other – so he had these big springy legs, these sort of boing-boing mm-hmm. contraptions. And some of the other athletes started getting a little annoyed that, you know, it's like he's on roller skates and or on a bike yeah. and we're running. So all these various committees had to get together and think about, well, is it okay to – and there was a lot of disagreement about it. So that's a long-winded answer to your question. There's lots of groups that weigh in on this. And they don't always see eye to eye.
And why would you argue that in the case of Lance Armstrong and other athletes that it's perfectly fine for them to keep injecting their own blood or, you know, to kind of do the same thing as with the altitude? There are not side effects from that? Or are the side effects equal as if you just go up in the mountains?
There might be different side effects. I mean, one of the problems with criminalizing this behavior is, as with all behaviors, when you make it illegal, you drive it underground. So one of the very bad side effects of the present policy is we have almost no research on what is safe and what is effective. So if these drugs have bad side effects, it's going to be very hard to find out about it because who's going to volunteer for research when it's illegal to use them? The second problem with criminalizing it is you have no oversight of the manufacturing process or the packaging process, so that athletes who get these drugs always, pretty much, maybe Russia's an exception, get them from the web or from offshore companies or Balco Labs in San Francisco, which was a notorious illegal operation. So you're getting things that are made in a bathtub with who knows what contaminants, how much hepatitis virus, how much HIV virus is in there. Nobody knows. You don't know what the dose is. You don't even know whether it's water in the bottle or a drug, never mind the dose of it. So I think there may be serious risks, and we haven't come to that yet, but the risks that are listed are usually pretty much either made up or wildly overstated. But it would be good to know. And the only way to know is to have them on the table and do research and so on.
But what about, just to carry it to extreme for the sake of argument, what if athletes use heroin or other narcotics?
Well, they do.
Yes. And I mean, are you arguing that everything should be legalized?
Well, that's a separate question, whether presently illicit drugs, whether criminalizing them is good social policy and whether that leads to a better world. You know, whether criminalizing heroin leads to more crime or less crime. I mean, there are other countries that have different policies about those drugs that seem to have less of a drug problem than the United States does. And, I mean, marijuana, most famously, we're just beginning to wake up after 50 years of reefer madness to the idea that marijuana is a lot safer than cigarettes, and that criminalizing it is very unjust. It winds up with minorities winding up in prison more than white people. I mean, there's all – I don't know that we want to get into the whole national policy on drug use in general, but I think there are more rational ways of dealing with that problem than our present method.
Well, we should talk about the ethics and how you approach this topic sort of from an ethical point of view. And we'll do that when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. From newspaper reports of the past month, you might conclude that the most contemptible human on the planet was Ben Johnson, the Canadian sprinter who tested positive for steroid use. He was sent home in disgrace, stripped of his gold medal, hounded by the press, and became the subject of an official inquiry. That's from a New York Times column, Ben Johnson, World's Fastest Scapegoat, from 1988, by my guest, Dr. Norman Faust. We were talking about your view, which started a decade earlier than that when you watched Olympiad stripped of his medal, about performance-enhancing drugs. Can you tell us about Ben Johnson in that case?
Yeah, that was the 88 Olympics, as you mentioned, and that really caused my blood to boil. So Johnson, as you said, as you pointed out, was a Jamaican-Canadian sprinter, broke the world record in the 100-meter dash, immediately tested positive for steroids and had his medal taken away, was banned for life. Huge national inquiry in Canada. They passed a law just to say how awful Ben Johnson is. And I'm watching all this, and no question he broke a rule, although I should say as an aside, it was a rule that was being obeyed by almost no one. That is, these drugs were practically on the training room table, and it was widely acknowledged, just as with Lance Armstrong. Everybody Lance Armstrong was competing against who testified against him said they were doing exactly what he was doing. And the same was true with sprinters. But that aside, he broke a rule, and you've got to play by the rules.
And so he was caught, which is part of the
– That's the word. That was his biggest mistake. But what troubled me about it – so I thought the rule was a crazy rule in the first place. But what really bothered me was the same day that Johnson is being interviewed in the press tent at the Olympics, in the same press tent, an hour later, this cute American swimmer named Janet Evans, who had just won a gold medal in swimming, was bragging about the greasy swimsuit that she had kept secret from the Russians and the East Germans, and that she was quite sure that it had shaved precious seconds off of her time. She was in a long-distance swim. But she was quite sure it was the difference between winning and losing. And she was especially proud of the fact that not only had American technology developed it, but kept it secret from the opponents. So here we had a guy who was using a drug that was not really an unfair advantage, at least many of his competitors were using it. And he gets vilified. And here you have this woman who is using something that she acknowledges was an unfair advantage. She's acknowledging that her opponents did not have it. She acknowledges that it was the difference between winning and losing. And she's declared America's sweetheart, goes on a lecture tour about everything that's good about sports, and 25 years later is still on a lecture tour as sort of the embodiment of purity in sports.
But isn't there a big difference between a swimsuit, which is outside your body, and then something you're taking that And maybe you can also explain the mechanism of those steroids, but don't they reduce pain? I mean, aren't they anti-inflammatory? They give you sort of almost a superhuman ability to tolerate pain?
Well, to answer your first question, the ethical issue, at least one of them that's alleged, is unfairness, is having an unfair advantage. And if that's the basic ethical issue, if that's at least a reason for banning these things, Janet Evans had an unfair advantage, bragged about it. Johnson probably didn't, and it struck me that that principle was not being fairly applied. So if that's going to be the ethical claim, we have to be consistent about it. And whether there's a rule or not about greasy swimsuits, if she says, I used something that my opponents didn't have, we at least, if we're not going to take her medal away, we should at least deplore it and say that, well, that's not what sport's supposed to be about. And whether it's external or internal, to me, is not of any great distinction. In the 72 Olympics, an American named Bob Segrin showed up for the pole vault with a fiberglass pole. Everybody else was using bamboo, and he went a foot higher than anybody.
So there wasn't like a standard pole they all had to use?
No, they also could, anybody could bring their own pole. And the official said, wait a minute, that's not right. And they prohibited him from using it. But by the 70s, they didn't then ban the fiberglass pole. By the 76 Olympics, it had caught on. Everybody had a chance to practice with it and get it. And now everybody uses fiberglass poles. So if equal opportunity and equal access to technology is part of fairness, it seems to me it doesn't matter whether that inequality is external or internal.
So by taking the steroids, tell me what difference that would have made to Ben Johnson.
So that's an interesting point, too, about and it gets to this treatment enhancement thing. So the way steroids work, there are probably several ways, but one of the main ways is they promote healing of injured muscles. So they were discovered, by the way, during World War II, used for American soldiers who had gunshot wounds and who had muscle damage, and it was discovered that giving them these anabolic steroids would help them heal more quickly. And then it spread to sports.
What does anabolic mean? I hear that term all the time. I don't really know what it means.
It means building up. Its opposite is catabolic. Catabolism is breaking down of tissue. Anabolic means building up tissue, so building up muscle in this case. So the way they work in otherwise healthy people is when you work out vigorously, whether it's running or weightlifting, you're constantly tearing little muscle fibers. And that's partly why you get fatigue. Part of what feeling sore after you work out is all about is you've got little muscle tears. So you've got inflammation. You've got the body trying to repair that. And so what the steroids do is they accelerate the healing. So what some athletes have figured out is that this isn't really enhancement. It's treatment of a disease. It's treatment of an injury. So let me give you a great example of that. Two of the great pitchers of all time are Roger Clemens and Andy Pettit, and they were teammates on the Yankees at one time. They were both exposed by the Mitchell Report, Senator Mitchell, who wrote a big report. And Mitchell concluded that Pettit and Clemens had both used steroids, even though they had never tested positive. There was lots of other evidence from guys who injected them that they were using these drugs. Clemens came out the next day and did this Clemens-like press conference, very angry, very combative, denying, called people names, got hauled before a congressional committee, had to testify under oath, was accused of perjury by the Justice Department, and was threatened with prison for not for using steroids, but for lying under oath. Pettit had a better lawyer, and the lawyer said, apologize, admit that you did it, and say that you didn't do it to enhance your performance. You did it because you had sore muscles, and your doctor told you that your muscles would heal better. He was just treating your injury and make it sound like medicine, which is a perfectly fine way of framing it. So whether it was enhancement or treatment is fuzzy. In my view, it doesn't matter. The question is whether we should allow people to do it or not do it. It's a long-winded answer to your question. They work by healing broken down muscles, which is treatment of an injury. Why should we be against treatment of injuries?
Okay.
Can I give another example of that?
Yeah.
It gets back to the Russians in the present Olympics. part of this investigation into the Russians. There were several roads that led to it, but one of them was the Sharapova incident. So Maria Sharapova, who's an iconic champion tennis player, one of the biggest draws on the tour, one of the world's leading models, in addition to being a great tennis pro. And she was caught earlier this year for using a drug called Meldrinate, also called Meldonium. It had been legal for a decade. She had been using it openly, violating nothing, as were hundreds of other Russian athletes and Europeans. For some reason, it's never caught on in the U.S., but Europeans were widely using it. In January 2016, it suddenly got banned. And she claimed to have missed the email. Hard to believe. She's probably got 97 assistants who read her email, but she somehow claimed not to know that and tested positive in March and was appropriately banned under the rule. Banned for 2 years. So here's one of the biggest draws in all of sports at the peak of her career is taken out of the arena. I've looked into this as deeply as I can. I can find no evidence that this drug has any performance-enhancing qualities or any serious risks. So sort of like the ephedrine that Damon used, why it's on the list escapes me. But even if it were effective, the way it's claimed to work, it's claimed to improve oxygen delivery to your tissues, possibly by dilating blood vessels when they get right to the muscle and improving blood flow, which would theoretically enhance performance. If you watch an NFL football game any Sunday, you'll see on the sidelines when the players come off the field, they go to the oxygen tank, they put a mask over their face, they inhale oxygen. Why? To improve oxygen delivered to their tissues. We know that works. It's obviously legal. Everybody does it. It's way more effective than this Meldrinate. Why isn't that banned? Well, why should it be banned? I mean, it's pretty safe. So if Meldrinate did increase oxygen flow to the tissues, why would that be a reason to ban it? It seems perfectly understandable that an athlete would want more oxygen to his or her tissues. So,
yeah, it's I see that it's complicated. But what about a situation, you know, I know there were some times in the past where some of the East German women who were taking steroids seem to, or testosterone perhaps, maybe you could talk a little bit about that, but they would seem to have a greater advantage over some of the other women by basically doping to the point of becoming more mannish.
Well, there's no question that these male-type steroids, anabolic steroids is another word for testosterone-like drugs. These are all male hormone-type drugs. And there's no question that they make you bigger and stronger and enhance your performance. That's one of the reasons men are better than women at a lot of sports, most sports, because they're bigger and stronger and have more muscles. So if women take them, they do become more man-like. In fact, there's an interesting example of this involving a South African woman named Caster Semenya, who's been a world-class athlete for several years. She looks very manlike. And in fact, she is manlike because she has a condition, a congenital disorder. She doesn't take any of these drugs as far as we know. She was born with an inborn error that caused her to make way more testosterone-type hormones than normal women do. And this was in utero. It affected her external genitalia. It affected her muscles. And she has been this way since infancy. And as a result, she looks for the world like most men on the track. She's winning. She's an elite athlete. She's one of the best runners in the world in the 800 meters. Well, a lot of her competitors feel this is unfair. Maybe she didn't take a drug, but she's got an advantage against the other women due to excessive amounts of testosterone. If she's allowed to compete with that body build, why shouldn't we be allowed to be at the same level and have the same levels of testosterone?
Well, I suppose there's a lot of disparity just in terms of genetics, because even, say, with Michael Phelps, his body type is quite different than a lot of the people he's competing with. You have some gymnasts where they're 4'8" and very flexible joints and everything else. So you're saying that to take a whole class of drugs and ban them, it still is not going to level the playing field in many ways.
sports is inherently unfair. That is, Shaquille O'Neal.
He's going to beat me.
No matter how much we work out, no matter how much steroids we take, we're not going to do very well against him or Michael Jordan or anybody else. So there's always that inherent unfairness that we can't do anything about. We're not going to ban Shaquille O'Neal because he's taller, stronger, faster, more agile than 99% of people on the planet. But what we can do is try to equalize things that can be equalized.
Except isn't the difference that one is a sort of given gift? I mean, it's something you're born with. It's the hands you were dealt. It's not artificially doing something.
Well, if you're going to ban artificial things, then we got to throw out the fiberglass poles and the shoes and the bikes and the swimsuits and the hats. I mean,
I can see that as a different category than, you know, I know another example where it gets a little murky is, if I remember right, Tiger Woods had laser eye surgery to get his vision.
LASIK.
To get it like 2015 or, you know, to get his vision better. That to me doesn't seem legal in a certain way. Because that's different than, but I suppose you would say then that some other golfers could wear special glasses. I don't know what the rules are there.
It's not banned. Or they can get LASIK surgery too. There's no rule against LASIK surgery. So you can either wear glasses or get the surgery or not do it.
So is the problem? I guess my kids always make fun of me because I hate competition. Like my favorite score is a tie, which doesn't make you a good spectator for sports. But I just like it where everybody ties and they go home happy. And I'm not big on the pressure to win. It seems to bring out in people just incredible aggression and finding all these ways to edge out someone else. Is the problem really the amount of value that our culture places on winning?
There's a lot of problems with that in sports and elsewhere in life. I mean, look at our political field in which the depth to which candidates are willing to go to win is gotten so repulsive that it turns almost everybody off. So there are problems with sports and the extent to which people will go to win, including cheating, including whacking your opponent's kneecaps, as happened to
Tanya Harding, the other one, Nancy Kerrigan.
Kerrigan. So these are despicable endpoints of this drive to win. So there's many problems with that. Well, my only view is, if we are going to have sports, and if winning is going to be important, and there's a lot of money to be made from winning, it's a profession, and we ought to try to have it be as fair as possible. And the issue we were talking about is, isn't there a certain unfairness in the genetic endowment that people have? And the answer is yes. And is that okay? Well, we don't think it's okay. We don't have men compete against women because we think there's genetic unfairness. We don't have people with disabilities competing against fully abled people because we think that's unfair competition. So we have a separate Olympics for people with disabilities. Well, there are other examples of innate abilities that lead to unfairness that we should maybe be trying to equalize. For example, when the University of Wisconsin football team plays Wofford College, the interior linemen have a 50-pound difference on both offense and defense. It doesn't seem very fair to me. There's more to football than just being big, but it's a big part of being a lineman. So, you know, we don't let 300-pound people wrestle 150-pound people. We don't let boxers compete at that level. Maybe we should try to equalize the weights in football. It wouldn't be technically hard to have a big scale on the sidelines and your interior lineman can weigh 5 tons or whatever the limit is, and they step on the scale, and if it goes over that, somebody has to get off. Or have the basketball team heights all programmed in, and you can't have more than 50 feet of height out there at any one time. So there's ways of equalizing these things. I mentioned the Caster Semenya, the woman who seems to have an unfair advantage. Another dramatic example of that was a Norwegian cross-country skier named Manta Ranta some years ago, who just won gold medals every time out. he had an inborn error that caused him to make more red cells than anybody else. So he had this jacked up hemoglobin level that gave him more endurance than everybody. It was clearly an advantage. Why not allow other people to get up to that level, whether it's by training at altitude or sleeping in a chamber or injecting EPO or using transfusions? So there are inequalities due to innate genetic gifts, but there are things we could do to try to equalize that.
Okay, so that's the ethical argument of, you know, keeping things sort of fair. But what about the argument that you shouldn't do harm, and that if you legalize steroids and all these other things, that you may be actually promoting dangerous side effects that will occur, that people who use steroids have been, you know, there is research, isn't there, that links them to some risk to the heart or to other problems that can come up?
You've been reading too many newspapers. Yeah, if you read the newspapers or listened to the, check the web, you would think that these drugs cause heart disease, cancer, stroke, and all sorts of horrible things. There are several problems with the argument based on harm, that we should ban them because they're harmful. First, good ethics starts with good facts. So if we're going to ban them based on harm, we ought to be clear about what the actual facts are. So let's just take steroids. Each drug is different, but let's take steroids, which are probably the most common. Everything you read on that topic will say they cause heart disease, cancer, and stroke. Well, when I have a debate on this subject with the official U.S. Olympic team physician, the guy who advises them in all this, a guy named Gary Wadler, and I'll say, Gary, could you name for me one athlete, just one, who's ever had a heart attack, a stroke, or cancer while he or she was on these drugs? And he says, oh, that's not the point. The point is that they're illegal. I said, yeah, but if they're one reason they're illegal is because they cause these things. Can you give me any evidence at all? And he can't. Okay, so he changes the subject because there is no evidence. Steroids, testosterone, was associated with fatal, untreatable liver cancer. That was 50 years ago when you took it by mouth. It was absorbed by your intestine, went straight to the liver. The liver got a big hit, and it clearly caused this fatal kind of cancer. For that reason, nobody takes testosterone anymore. They use modern variants on the molecule, which have never been associated with liver or any other kind of cancer. They take it by injection, so it gets diluted out in the blood, so there's nanogram amounts by the time it arrives at the liver. So there's no cancer effect. But Lyle Alzado, an all-star, all-pro lineman who died of a brain tumor while he was still active, was interviewed for a cover story of Sports Illustrated in the front page of the New York Times, Lyle Alzado, steroid user, dying of brain cancer. And Alzado admitted that he'd been using steroid for 10 years. Nowhere in the New York Times or Sports Illustrated was there a single quote from a single physician about any known association between steroids and brain cancer, because there is none. There's none. He's the only person in the history of the world who had this rare tumor. So a lot of these side effects and these harm things are made up. That's the first point, or exaggerated. Steroids do affect your blood lipids in a bad way. Your good cholesterol goes down, your bad cholesterol goes up. So if you took them for 10, 15 years and you had other risk factors, they could be a tipping point. And there's some evidence that they are. But we're talking here about elite athletes who are on great diets, who mostly don't have other risk factors, and the number of years that they use them. There's as yet no population-based evidence that they're at any higher risk than anybody else. Secondly, the risk of the sports are generally much higher than the drugs. That is, even if you look at the made-up risks, the ones that Wadler claims there's been 10 deaths from steroids, 10. The number of people who have died from playing football is somewhere around 1,000. Well, the denominator is a little different. There are more deaths from playing baseball than due to steroids.
Or skiing or lots of other
activities. Bungee jumping, driving your motorcycle without a helmet. That is, Americans behave in crazy ways. And usually, if they're not hurting anybody else, we allow competent adults to take risks. And playing football is one of them. There's great reward and there's great risk. There's a very high probability of permanent severe disability if you play football for 3 years or more in the National Football League. That may lead someone like yourself to say it's a reason to ban it, but generally we don't have such rules banning people from doing these things. So third, there's hypocrisy with regard to the not just death, but the disability rate from the violence, the planned violence of football and hockey, which doesn't have to be part of the sport. That is, we could change the rules of football and reduce the incidence of concussions. The NFL is starting to do that mainly to avoid lawsuits, but there's much more they could do. We could not allow youth football, and child brains are much more vulnerable, it seems, than adult brains. But what do the professional leagues do? They encourage violence. That is, they show us films of the NFL's greatest hits, and hockey would have no fans if it weren't for the fighting and the violence that breaks out. So these claims about harm are either exaggerated, made up, very paternalistic to a degree that we don't allow in other areas of adult risk-taking behavior.
A few more thoughts on the ethics of banning doping when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Faust, and we are talking about let them take steroids, an argument, very controversial one, about legalizing performance-enhancing drugs. You've talked about the fact that there are other ways to keep things fair. I mean, there's other kinds of unfairness within sports and that they're not as harmful as the sports themselves. But what about the idea that it's a bad role model for children? We don't want to kind of get across the message that whenever you can't win, you look for something to take so that you will win.
Well, it is a problem in the role modeling and the imitation that goes on in children. And in fact, steroids themselves are widely used by middle school children and high school kids. A lot of it, by the way, doesn't seem related so much to sports as it does to attracting girls. That is, it's boys that mainly take them for bodybuilding, but some athletes do take them. And I'm totally against that for a couple of reasons. One, there are adverse effects in children that aren't relevant to adults. They will stunt your growth. If you take these when you're 12, 13, 14, it can knock many, many inches off your final adult height, and most people would prefer to be a little bit taller. So that's a side effect to worry about. Children obviously can't weigh that kind of risk against the benefits. They're not competent. So I'm totally against banning them in children. I don't mind having children be tested, not to punish them, but as canaries in the coal mine to find out who the peddlers are, because they're probably peddling other bad things. And I think anybody who sells these things to kids ought to be hung, followed by a fair trial. What worries me more about role modeling, frankly, is the violence of sports, both the on-field violence, the promotion of trying to kill the quarterback, cause concussions, get people out of the game, incapacitate them, and frankly, the sexual violence of elite athletes. The incidence of sexual assault by elite athletes in both football and basketball at both the professional and the collegiate level is astonishing.
Is some of that, though, the testosterone they're taking?
Probably not, no. I mean, because the testing for steroids is pretty good in both the college and the NFL. It's hard to get away with steroids these days. Steroids can aggravate that. But the overwhelming majority of these cases are just people using their innate abilities. And what's the message we send? Oh, a little community service and miss a game or two and everybody's back on the field. I mean, a wide receiver for the Cleveland Browns killed a guy drunk driving and got a suspension and was back on the field. He would have had a worse suspension for using steroids than for killing somebody while being a drunk driver. So it's that role modeling to kids. You can get away with it. If you're an elite athlete, you can get away. I mean, look at our swimmers in the recent Olympics, who these elite athletes who think they can go wreck a gas station, pee on the floor, lie, and somehow imagine they could get away with this. Where did they learn that? Well, from decades of seeing other athletes being protected when they acted out.
Sort of the celebrity status that we give our athletes. Yeah. You talk in some of the articles that you've written about, I guess, the stigma attached to a word like doping. And it certainly is different if I say doping than if I say performance-enhancing drugs, just the language that we're using. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, the whole debate of this topic has been so one-sided for 40 years. You have trouble finding articles representing this contrary point of view. And part of that one-sidedness is just the use of this word doping, which comes from an old term related to heroin. It was a word whose root sounded like dope. And so heroin use decades ago came to be known as dope, and people who used it as dopers or people. But it has this other meaning of being a dope and being stupid. So anything that's performance-enhancing in sports suddenly becomes doping. I mean, people who inject blood are somehow doping. So it's another way of stigmatizing, as you put it, the whole activity, using a pejorative word, mm-hmm. and it inhibits rational discussion.
You know, you make really good arguments. I get the reasoning behind them. I understand the ethical issues and so on. But I'm still clinging to something. I'll just describe it. Okay, let's say that we've watched Michael Phelps win, you know, his 20th and 23rd medal, whatever. We see him in the water straining with all his strength. And then we've watched Simone Biles with her beautiful floor exercises and so on. I think there's something in most of us that wants to just think, this is an athlete that has worked so hard, so many hours, has done everything they can to use the gifts that they have with their body and to also use their mind and to just really work hard to give us what is such a beautiful presentation of the human body and what it can do. That when you introduce then, oh, maybe so-and-so took this. I mean, we don't want to find out that they were taking something that might have given them an edge over the person who was crying in the stands because they didn't win. I mean, how do you justify sort of saying, well, let everybody take everything?
Well, I don't think everybody should take anything. But on the other hand, the naked Olympics are not coming back. That is, this fantasy that sports is about people just competing only with their God-given abilities, that went away 2,000 years ago when the first Greek runner put on shoes. So there never has been such a world, or at least there hasn't been for thousands of years. So Michael Phelps and everybody else out there did put in 10,000 hours, as all great people do, as Malcolm Gladwell has told us. And no matter what you do well in, you have to work really hard. But everybody else is putting in the same number of hours. And the difference between winning and losing is not just trying real hard and working out. It's other things that give you an edge, whether it's training at altitude or the greasy. Look, Michael Phelps has some weird swimsuit
cupping,
on.
And he had cupping.
And all those
things.
Weird patches all over the place. You may have read, you may have noticed in the Olympics, the female swimmers, I'm not so sure about the men, had two hats on. They would take off their bathing cap, and there'd be another bathing cap. What was that all about? Well, it turns out the outer cap is silicone, and that glides through the water better than other materials, but it slips off your head. So they put on one cap to stick to their head and then another cap to hold the silicone on, and they think it makes a difference. And as you pointed out, you know, a hundredth of a second can be winning and losing. Mm-hmm. So every one of them out there is using some technology, external and internal, on top of their incredible native talent and on top of their incredible hard work. Emily, if you and I started taking steroids and growth hormones and EPO this afternoon, none of us is going to be in the Olympics.
Nope. That's for sure.
And even with the 10,000 hours, we're not going to be in the Olympics. So there's many things that go into a champion, and effort and genetics is part of it. But there's, for every one of them, there's some technology that's enhancing their performance.
Thank you for being my guest. It's given me a lot to think about.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
My guest has been Dr. Norman Faust. I'm Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join me for the next hour of University of the Air.